This is Adam Culbertson from the Microphones and Monsters podcast, and you're listening to Tale of the Manticore.
The following podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Tale of the Manticore, Season 2. Like the creature from which it takes its name, Tale of the Manticore is a mashup, a crossbreeding between two different species of storytelling. Here, you will find the unpredictability of old-school RPG paper and dice games with the storycraft of a dark fantasy novel. No character is sacred, and no character will be spared if the dice decide their fate is at hand. According to lore, the tail of a manticore is barbed with cruel iron spikes. There will be much pain in the days ahead. Last time, on Tale of the Manticore. In the last chapter, the companions continued their exploration of Whitestone Castle on their quest to find out what happened there, and also if King Culfrey is still alive. The mystery of the dead courtier and the unknown beast that killed her intensifies when the PCs find a pile of bodies on the Great Hall's marble steps. These bodies, they deduce, must belong to one of Koch's lost patrols, the ones he sent to investigate and who never returned. Due to some lucky dice rolls, the party does not encounter the Yeth Hound as they proceed upstairs and, following a trail of blood, come to a door that has been barricaded on the other side. Just as Yellowfly decides to begin actively looking for the thing that haunts Whitestone, Catsbane suggests that they go to Carrick's tower and retrieve an item he knows to be there, a pot of magical sleeping powder. Yellowfly agrees, and the party moves away from the spoor they were following. Now, the castle crawl continues, starting where the players left off, in the Pink Room, a kind of lesser version of the Great Hall. Chapter 63, Part 1, Day 183, Late Morning. Party status: Yellowfly, 39 of 39 hit points. Shawnee, 30 of 30. Jace, 45 of 45. Catsbane, 17 of 17. Bazu, 16 of 16. Spells available: Catsbane has memorized Magic Missile, times 2, Invisibility, Mirror Image, Haste, and Slow. Bazu has prayed for Cure Light Wounds, times 2, Bless, and Silence, 15-foot radius. Catsbane sniffed and looked away from the portrait of Culfrey's niece. At the western end of the Pink Room's T-top were two exits. A set of tablet-shaped double doors with stylized rounded tops was in front of them, and a small archway was just to the left of these. Catsbane thought the tablet doors would take them nearer to Carrick's tower, and he whispered as much to Yellowfly in front of him. The lantern he now carried did a fair job illuminating the room, but using it made Catsbane realize how accustomed he had become to being able to see in the dark, and now that the ability was gone, how much he had taken it for granted. Lamplight was a poor substitute for the crisp and detailed grayscale of infravision. Still, he knew in his heart that he needed to avoid using that kind of magic whenever possible. It had been drawing him in by inches, and he only realized how far he had gone when he had abruptly stopped. The bad dream from the night before was still fresh in his head. It had been a message, of course, either from the demon itself, or else from his own subconscious mind, a reminder that he would not be allowed to simply turn his back on the demonic powers with which he had become associated. As Yellowfly and Jace did, Catsbane glanced to the left and down through the small arch. It went 40 feet through a guard room that ended in yet another arch, this one of blocky, basic design. Catsbane could also see a door he could tell would take them back to the staircase landing. His attention returned to Yellowfly, who put his hand to the tablet double doors and swung them inward. The glow from his lantern was overtaken by natural light from the room beyond. They entered a place he had heard about, but to which he had never been. It was instantly identifiable by its shape as Whitestone Castle's Oval Room. 30 feet across at its widest, and 60 at its longest, the oval room's corners had been rounded off with bright white alabaster, or some other kind of plaster, to give the room its unique shape. The design did not seem to serve any functional purpose, and had likely been built this way purely for aesthetics. Once they had entered, Catsbane thought it felt a little like standing inside a giant eggshell. directly across from where the companion stood were a second identical pair of tablet doors. A round top arch cut another way back east. A single, perfectly oval-shaped window let in sunlight and a cool breeze that ruffled the nearby tapestry. The expertly woven piece depicted a pitched battle between sword-wielding knights and reptilian monsters. Unlike any of the other rooms they had seen, the oval room had a floor of polished marble that reflected the sunlight and imbued the room with a gentle luminosity, possibly meant as a tasteful transition from the adjoining pink room. Several niches had been cut into the wall, with their insides painted a soft coral hue. Each niche was just large enough to support a vase the size of a bottle of wine. Normally, these would contain a single red, white, or pink rose, depending on the time of year or the monarch's preference. But today they contained flowers that hung their heads as if in despair, wilted and dead. As Shanae entered, the tablet doors, painted white on this side and pink on the other, swung shut with muted grace. Despite the refined elegance on display, Yellowfly was all business. When he looked at Catsbane for direction, the mage indicated the tablet doors opposite them. Yellowfly crossed the room under the white vaulted ceiling and pushed at them. Beyond was another hall lacking natural light. Catsbane held up his lantern as they all walked to where it terminated in a kind of nexus, with rooms opening before them to the north and west and a hallway turning south that extended into darkness. Catsbane recognized the room to the north and signaled Yellowfly to go there. The fighter, with Jace at his side, led the way into another library. This one lacked the uniform and unused formality of the library on the first floor. All of the bookshelves were open-faced. They were home to a hodgepodge of tomes, curios, statuettes, candlesticks, little chests, and on one shelf, a human skull missing the jawbone. There was a desk, several chairs, and a low table, all arranged haphazardly, with some supporting open books. In the back, a narrow stone staircase led up to the third floor. "You've been here before," asked Yellowfly, turning to face Catsbane.
"Not exactly. I've seen this room from the other side."
He pointed to a corner that took the convex shape of Carrick's Tower. Set into it was a door of banded oak. Catsbane smiled at it wanly. He had not used this entrance himself, but he had been the one to answer the door when Bellagret, the royal niece, had come knocking one day to casually ruin his life. Then again, after all, perhaps she had not. Thinking of the man he was now compared to the boy he had been, maybe she had saved him. Dramatis Personae, Catsbane. 4 years ago.
One hourglass, one scale, one Eludel, four retorts, 14 ceramic cups, one chipped at the rim, and 277 empty glass jars.
Phelan Orla wiped his brow, exhausted, having finally inventoried the full contents of Carrick's laboratory. It was day one of his new apprenticeship, and in addition to fatigue, he felt a kind of jittery, nervous energy that was most unpleasant. His former master, Xavion the Red, had given him the advice to count every single piece of equipment and commit the numbers to memory as his very first priority. While Xavion's laboratory was a chaotic jumble of mismatched items, Carrick's was meticulously well-ordered, and it was known that the Archmagus brooked no laxity in his apprentice's attention to detail. Xavion had warned that Archmagus Carrick would be sure to inspect his work, looking for errors. No sooner had Phelan finished than the door to the laboratory opened and his new master stepped through from the adjoining library. The old wizard strode briskly across the room and then stopped abruptly, turning to face Phelan. His expression went from distracted concern to realization.
"You must be my new apprentice,"
he declared. Phelan swallowed and nodded, bowing slightly.
"Well, you look strong and able."
Yes, master,
Phelan found himself saying. The words came out awkwardly. Carrick picked up and inspected a glass jar. His clear, dark eyes lingered upon it for what felt like too long before he replaced it.
"Well, I will see you sometime. On no account are you to go upstairs. I have set a number of wards there, and if you try, you will die. Clear? Good."
Carrick didn't wait for an answer, but finished crossing the laboratory and then disappeared up the stairs, with his cloak billowing out behind him. Phelan didn't see his new master again for weeks. His life quickly descended into a routine of solitary monotony, with so much expected of him in terms of keeping up the laboratory and caring for its exotic creatures that, by the time his work was done, he rarely had the energy for personal pursuits. Carrick kept a pixie in a jar that Phelan, if he were being honest, had been immediately smitten by. She possessed an exquisitely delicate form and a face of such beauty that Phelan's heart ached to look upon her. But the pixie wept and sobbed all day, every day, and it was not long before the relentless noise overrode his feelings of infatuation, and, as the unceasing sound threatened to drive him mad, he eventually began to wish she were not there at all. One day, after about 2 months into his new apprenticeship, Phelan was, as usual, cleaning the laboratory when he suddenly recalled Carrick's first, and practically only, words to him.
You look strong and able.
That was a strange thing to say to your new servant. Unless, Phelan wondered what had become of the previous apprentice. Later, he would hear rumors. The woman had broken a retort and been dismissed. He had heard that one from a courier. A door guard had once grinned at him and swore that she had gone insane and then died after inhaling poisonous vapors. By now, Phelan wondered if the old apprentice had simply been just that. Old. Too old to work. And if that was true, the implications were not good. He tried not to think about it, but couldn't help let his eyes drop to the floor, to the place where he had knelt to clean Carrick's onyx slab. Whenever he polished that stone, he felt like a priest praying at an altar. He saw what he expected, but hoped not to see. Right where his knees had been, two slight indentations, almost, but not quite, imperceptible, on the floor.
With your long-forgotten name, we call upon you.
We call upon you.
In the words of the unspeakable language, we call upon you.
We call upon you.
By the spilt blood of the wicked who walk upon this world sprouting the words of false idols, we call upon you.
We call upon you.
On the land of the dead harvest, that which brings the earth itself into your service, Yamal, we call upon you.
We call upon you. We call upon you. We call upon you.
The Sprouting, a Call of Cthulhu actual play podcast by Blighthouse Studio. Find us on your podcatcher of choice.
I wonder, would the door to the second level of Carrick's tower be locked? I think there's a pretty good chance it would be. I'll say there's a 4 in 6 chance it is. A 1 to 4 means yes. Rolling. I've got a 4. Well, Shawnee can try and pick the lock. And, as an 8th level thief, she has a 65% base chance for success, plus an additional 10% for her magical gloves. Rolling percentile to see if she succeeds. I've got a 51. Nicely done, Shawnee. Chapter 63. Part 2. Day 183. Late morning. Party status. The party status is unchanged. The door clicked open after a few minutes, and Shawnee removed a pair of wires, one straight and one hooked, from the lock mechanism. She put these tools back into their purse, which she tucked into her belt before standing up and making way for Catsbane to open the door.
Thank you, Shawnee.
While he and Yellowfly went in, she stayed behind with Bazu and Jace, taking her bow from her shoulder and knocking an arrow. For Catsbane, walking into Carrick's laboratory was like stepping back in time. The single small window had been shuttered, but the lantern lit the whole space well enough. Almost everything was just as he remembered. The lament of the pixie was absent. He could see her tiny dead body crumpled up inside its glass prison on the shelf. This room had always had a complicated mix of odors, smelling at once acrid, sweet, and simply weird. Those smells were still present, but there were others present too now. Notes of decay and garbage. Catsbane wasted no time reminiscing. He scanned the orderly but overfilled shelves, saw what he wanted, and crossed the room, where he selected a small, flat green jar that looked like two saucers sandwiched together. Yellowfly was at the door, half in and half out of the laboratory.
Did you find what you were looking for?
He asked with a tone that suggested impatience.
This is the agent that I was speaking of, yes,
confirmed Catsbane.
But since we are here, there may be other items of use upstairs. Do you think that we should check?
Catsbane had, at some point in their time together, explained where he had gotten the crystal shard that had exploded with cold magic and allowed them to escape the smuggler's channel. Judging by Yellowfly's expression, he had no desire to accompany Catsbane up the stairs.
Or I could go alone.
Yellowfly sucked his teeth momentarily, then said, Go if you must, but be quick about it, and leave us the lantern. The other room is as dark as night. Once again, Catsbane regretted not preparing his spell of Infravision. Still, nobody knew this laboratory better than he did, and he was able to produce a little lamp meant for use with the alembic. After retrieving it from a storage cabinet, he lit it from the lantern. Now they both had a light.
Be quick, Catsbane reminded him. And Catsbane, be careful.
The young magic user nodded, and, holding the little lamp, ascended the stairs to Carrick's private room. Catsbane moves about the laboratory with familiar ease, but he's going to need at least 5 or 10 minutes to look through Carrick's private room on the third floor, possibly more. No matter how quick he is, I'm going to need to roll at least one more wandering encounter check. Let's do it now. As always, the roll is made with a d6, and a 1 on the die means the Yethhound has found them. Here comes the roll. Oh boy, there it is. A 1. Well, it had to happen sooner or later. The Yethhound is coming. Or, is it possible that the monster has made a home of Carrick's tower? That's very unlikely. I've got this d6 in my hand already. Why not? I'll roll it and say on a 6, the Yethhound will be somewhere in the tower. Maybe upstairs, maybe downstairs. Any other result means it comes from somewhere in the castle proper. Rolling. I've got a 2. That's lucky for Catsbane, who might have had to face it alone. But no, it's not in the tower. Instead, it's either on the third floor of the castle, or it's approaching the library from the direction the PCs came. Here comes a high-low roll. High means it comes from the third floor. A 4. Okay, now we know where it is. One more pair of rolls. Will either side be surprised? I'm really putting this little d6 to work because I'll be using it to determine this, too. A 1 or a 2 indicates surprise for either side. Rolling for the PCs. A 5. Good. This is going to be tough enough. Now the roll for the thing that was once Krell. Whoa, look at that. A 1. That's great news. I wonder what this will look like in the narrative. Okay. I think I've got it. Yellowfly was standing right in the doorway to the laboratory, half in and half out. Shawnee was covering the library door with her bow. Bazu was trying to read the spines of books in the very low light, and Jace was watching the stairs when they heard it. First, the click of nails on the stone floor, then a huffing sound, like labored breathing. Yellowfly was quick to close the lantern so that only a little light escaped. Everyone looked to him for instructions, and he decided that this was as good a place as any to make a stand. He pointed at each individual member of his party and signaled clear instructions. Jace tucked himself into a nook behind the staircase. Shawnee took up a position behind a thick oak chair with a wide back, swapping her bow for her sword. Bazu hid behind a protruding bookcase, gripping his quarterstaff tightly. Yellowfly ducked a little further into his doorway after setting the lantern on the floor a few feet away and opening its door a few more inches. Although not exactly bright, the room was now well lit enough for everyone to see, more or less. Still, they did not poke their heads out or try to steal a glance, as the light, meant to attract the creature at the stairs, did its work. Within a few seconds of putting the lantern on the floor, the heavy huffing sound grew louder. It was very close now, right at the top of the stairs. Bazu flattened himself against the wall, wondering if he would know when the time to strike was right. Shawnee, Jace, and Yellowfly all readied their blades as quietly as they could. Then, they waited. Don't you love it when a scene in a game of D&D is so clear in your mind that you could almost imagine being there? In my head, I'm with the PCs as they hide, holding their breath and waiting while the creature draws nearer. It's a moment of delicious tension that will get even better when the Yethhound is in the room. Of course, I didn't pause the action to ask you to imagine the scene. I did so because I need to figure out if Catsbane would know what's going on, and if so, how he might react. When Yellowfly closed the lantern, Catsbane was on the stairs. The stairs followed the inner curvature of the tower wall, and might put him out of sight of everything happening below, and Yellowfly cannot risk giving him an audible signal either. The only chance Catsbane has to be aware that anything was happening is if he notices the light suddenly going out. This might cause him to come back and investigate. Would he notice? Let's give him a skill check against wisdom as an ad hoc passive perception check. His wisdom score is, let's see, oh, it's pretty good at 14. I'll roll a d20, and in this case, lower is better. The roll. A 9. He does notice, and so stops his ascent, putting out his own small lamp with a wetted thumb and finger. Given the success, I'm going to allow him to participate in the ambush, but he won't be able to change his location. He'll have to remain on the stairs, watching through the door to the library where Yellowfly is standing, tensed and ready, with the Silverthorn in his hand. Before we proceed, a couple of things to mention about Yellowfly. Firstly, back in episode 56, Yellowfly leveled up and his strength went from a 15 to a 16. At the time, I mentioned being disappointed because this did not indicate a change in his attack bonus, but I was wrong. A couple of listeners reached out to let me know that in AD&D, the 16 strength is a mere plus 1, but in BX, it's actually a plus 2. To be honest, I played AD&D much more as a kid than I did BX, and I simply had my facts wrong. I seem to do this kind of thing a lot, especially to Fly. Sorry, Fly. Please don't take it personally. There's one more thing, and thankfully this time it's not another oversight. I've mentioned before that the Silverthorn Blade is much more than a simple plus 2 longsword, at least for some folks. Wielded by anyone of good alignment, it has the additional benefit of being plus 3 versus demons, undead, abominations, and the like, and Krell certainly falls into that last category. In the hands of a paladin, it is a true holy adventure blade. I doubt we'll ever get to see the Silverthorn in its full glory, but there it is anyway. Alright, I think we're ready to get back to the action, and I think we'll need some really tense music for a scene like this. Everyone held their breath, tensed and ready to strike when the time came. They could tell it was at the top of the stairs, though they did not peek out from cover to look. If they had dared to, they would have seen a creature that was roughly the size and shape of a lion, though dark gray in color, and covered with a wrinkled and leathery hide, not fur. There was a large fleshy hump on its back, which gave it a pitched forward look. The paws were the size of bear paws, and each was equipped with 4 3-inch long, sickle-shaped claws of ochre hue. The face was the most awful to behold. The maw was a blood-encrusted jumble of fangs set into black gums. The snout was flattened, but there was a kink halfway up where Krell had once had his nose broken, and the deformity had survived his transformation. The eyes were almost human, though clouded with rage and hunger and bestial immediacy. Step by step, it navigated the stairs, snuffling through its flattened nose, catching the scent of nearby prey. Click. Click. Another step. The companions waited, summoning their courage. Dog, bear, or wolf, whatever it was big and heavy. Click. Click. The companions tried not to move, minutely adjusting their sweaty grips on the hilts of their weapons. Now it was in the library with them, huffing and taking ponderous steps. It made slowly, but directly, for the light of the partially opened lantern. Once, it hesitated and made as if to turn. Jace almost struck, but he managed to stay his hand just in time, and the lumbering monster returns its attention to the light, letting free a low, stuttering growl. The moment it crossed Yellowfly's vision, the fighter yelled,
"No!"
and all 5 of them burst out from hiding to attack.
Entering combat.
If the companions had not been veterans of many battles, including fights with terrible things like a carrion crawler, a harpy, and a pair of ragodessas, they might have fallen back screaming in terror at the deformed and hideous thing in their midst. But they did master their initial revulsion, and, having taken the Yethhound by surprise, each of them will get 1 free attack as we enter round 1. Since this is a surprise round, there is no need for an initiative roll. Each party member will get a free attack. We'll begin with Yellowfly, who's closest. The Silverthorn can recognize this creature as the kind of monster it was created to destroy, and seems to cut through the air with a will of its own as Yellowfly aims his strike. Even so, he'll need a 9 to hit the Yethhound's incredibly high AC of 19. The roll. A 9. That just hits. Yethhounds take a magical weapon's plus as damage, so it takes 3 points, and Yellowfly draws a white line of light into the beast's flesh with his blade. Shaunae is right there to follow up. She doesn't know it, but her non-magical blade cannot hurt this creature.
still, it'd be useful for her to find out, so I'm still rolling to hit. She needs a 17. A 6 is not even close. Jace is in the same boat, but as he springs up from behind, he'll need a 15. Oh dear, I've got a 7. He can't connect, and the beast leaps to the side and straight through one of the wooden tables as it evades him, smashing it to splinters. Bazu aims his staff. A 17? That's just enough to score a hit, but in a shower of black sparks, his well-placed strike is repulsed from the monster's hide, leaving no mark. Catsbane is the last to go. He is a room away, standing on the steps going up to Carrick's private chamber, but he can see the battle through the open door. He's going to cast Magic Missile. When he fought Suro and Romola, he cast the spell with his hands, but this time he makes the telepathic link with the extraplanar creature from which he originally acquired the spell, and he lets his third eye open. From it, he sends a triple blast of arcane force bolts. No two-hit roll is required. These missiles will strike and can damage the Yethound. They slam into it for 3d6 plus 3 damage, rolling it all together. Wow, 18 points! The bolts smash into its flank and send it flying across the library where it collides with the bookshelf. Old volumes and curios topple all over the floor and raise a cloud of dust. The monster's yelp has a quality to it that is undeniably human. Krell now has only 10 hit points left and will have to roll a morale check before he can take any other action. It looks like Catsbane has once again earned the MVP prize, but this battle has only just begun. Let's move on to round 2. Initiative. The Yethound. A 4. The party. A 3. Krell is able to recover quickly and picks himself up from the wreckage of the bookcase. Will he flee? Let's see. A quick search on the internet tells me these creatures are essentially fearless. I'll say it has the highest possible morale of 12. Rolling 2d6, and only on a 12 will it flee. 7 on the dice. It stays. Without question, it will now use its special fear attack. Here's how it works. When a hound of Yeth bays, the noise causes everyone within 90 feet of the monster to save versus spells or else flee in panic. The Monster Manual 2 doesn't say how long this effect lasts, so I'll say it's the same as the clerical spell, Cause Fear, which lasts for 20 minutes. Shawnee and Jace have the worst chance for success here, needing to roll a 14 or better. For Shawnee, that's partly due to her wisdom penalty. Here's the roll. A 9. She is going to run for it. Jace has no such penalty, but still needs a 14. A 10 is a failure. Bazu has a wisdom bonus, but still needs an 11 or better. A 16. He finds the courage to stay and fight. I wonder if he'll be the only one. Yikes, I hope not. Yellowfly also needs an 11. His roll. A 15. Holding the Silverthorn somehow gives him the strength to remain, even when it feels his guts have turned to ice. Now for the last roll. If Catsbane makes this save, he still has one magic missile left that could end this fight in the same impossibly quick way he defeated Suro and Romola, but he'll need to roll at least an 11. His roll. A 2. Catsbane cannot overcome the imperative in his brain that commands him to get away from here as quickly as possible. Bazu and Yellowfly can each take an action this round, having made their saves. Bazu, not knowing what else to do, will try to strike the creature again. A 16 is a great roll, but is a miss. Yellowfly with a Silverthorn. Oh no, I've rolled a 1. I think Shawnee, shrieking hysterically, has shoved him roughly against the wall as she bolts past him, thinking of nothing but escape. Yellowfly hits it hard and is momentarily stunned. He'll lose his next turn. While Shawnee runs south, back the way she came into the library, Jace takes the nearest way out for him, too. That means he sprints up the stairs to the third level. Catsbane, already halfway up the stairs to Carrick's chamber, will also take the path of least resistance and dash up the tower stairs the rest of the way. That leaves a stunned Yellowfly and a powerless Bazu standing alone against the hulking and deformed creature of Yeth, which, drooling madly through a double row of fangs, seems almost to smile at them, dog-like, as it advances. Thank you for listening to Tale of the Manticore. If you enjoy the show and would like to help to support it, there are lots of ways to do so. You can recommend it online or to friends. You can like and retweet episode announcements on social media. You can pick up One Shot in the Dark, the Pendulum Worldbuilding Tool, or Encyclopedia Manticorica on DriveThruRPG. And finally, you can rate or review the show on your podcatcher of choice. My thanks to everyone who supports the show. At this time, please allow me to share one of your very kind reviews. This review is from Castbox and was left by Tucker Raider.
Tucker Rader writes, awesome, listened, and liked every episode. Short and sweet. Thank you very much, Tucker Rader. I'd also like to take a moment now to thank my awesome voice talent. This episode contains the voice of Kai Allen in his usual role of Catsbane. I'm also pleased to have Josh of Mudbeggar Games back on the show in his role of Carrick Melmar. Thanks very much, Kai Allen and Josh. Finally, a special thanks to the band Just One Fix for the use of their songs Red Dawn and Hades Rising. Find Just One Fix on Bandcamp for some thrash metal goodness. For listeners who'd like to get in touch with me, I'm at Manticore Tale on X or Tale of the Manticore Podcast on Instagram. If you prefer email, I'm at taleofthemanticore@gmail.com. Finally, I keep a blog where I post all kinds of show and RPG-related stuff, like art, maps, tables, crafts, and show notes. You can find it at taleofthemanticore.blogspot.com. The adventure will continue on the next episode of Tale of the Manticore, the story where chaos rolls. Introducing Dread Maps, your gateway to immersive tabletop RPG battle maps. Unleash spine-chilling atmosphere and epic detail that dare you to zoom in. Elevate your gaming experience where every inch tells a story. Dungeons that beckon interaction. Multi-level mansions and castles with eldritch secrets. Dread Maps is available on Foundry, DriveThruRPG, Roll20, and Patreon. Find out more at patreon.com/dreadmaps. Evoke the most epic quest with Dread Maps today.